Okay. I'll call the House and Senate Transportation meeting together. We're having a joint meeting today. It's very nice when we can have these joint meetings because it really makes it a lot easier for our presenters. So we have two presenters today. We have the railroad, the Alaska Railroad, and we also have the Kibata. Oh, that's next time. Okay, Port of Anchorage, yes. Port of Anchorage, and then the next week we have Kibata. So anyway, let the record show that the meeting was called to order at 2 minutes after one. And again, we have the, well, Senator Kukesh, I'll let you announce your senators, and then I will do my representatives.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate all of you who have shown up here to join us in the meeting today. We have four members of the Senate that should be here today, but the two important ones are here, so I'm really glad they're here. Senator Egan and Senator Joe Thomas from Fairbanks. Senator Egan from Juneau and Senator Joe Thomas from Fairbanks, and I really appreciate their attendance. And I'm sure the other two will join us. It's Senator Linda Menard and Senator Charlie Huggins. So appreciate that, and I'll go ahead and turn it back over to you.
Okay. And for the House side, we have Representative Pruitt, Representative Peterson, Representative Gruenberg, and myself, Representative Wilson. And I'd also like to recognize our staff today. And over in this corner, we have Carrie Cooper Ryder, who is our House Recording Secretary. And on this side, we have, and raise your hands, we have Ryan Wilson, who is our LIO monitor. Thank you very much. Without these important people, we wouldn't be able to conduct our business. So my committee aide is Becky Rooney, and the Senate aide is Nancy Barnes.
Barnes.
She's
yes.
Right over there. So before we start, please turn off your cell phones. Even if they're on to vibrate, they do interfere with our system. So if you would just turn them off, and you can turn them back on when you hit the hall. So we're continuing our overviews today. And it'll help us prepare as we go through the bills for the system if we know a lot more about the transportation system across Alaska. So today we're going to hear from the Alaska Railroad, and I'd like to welcome the new CEO, Christopher Adnison.
Adnison.
Okay. You come with 37 years of railway experience, so Mr. Adnison, if you would come forward, and would you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Okay, shall do. My name is Christopher Adnison. I am president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
See, we've learned something already. We know how to pronounce your name.
I just learned it several weeks ago. It's been a tough thing to live with for 62 years.
Here's a good one for you. I got introduced one time, and a guy pronounced my name wrong, and I said, I know it's so hard about my name. It's very easy to spell. It's A-L-B-E-R-T.
Yeah. Yeah, Christopher Adnison's a large name, so I use Chris. Don't use the last name unless I have to.
Okay.
Okay, would you like me to proceed, or?
Please.
Okay,
go along, if any of the members have questions, just raise your hands, and I will recognize you, and I think it's easier, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a railroading fan, I understand you have a really extensive resume with your background in railroading. Madam Chair, could he tell us what his background is?
Go right ahead.
Be happy to do that. I do have almost 38 years of railroad experience now. I actually started in a survey crew at Western Pacific Railroad in San Francisco in 1973. And I worked up through the ranks at that railroad and ending up as the final general superintendent of transportation for that company before it was swallowed up by Union Pacific in 1983. At one point in there, for a railroad fan, I was the youngest division superintendent in the history of that railroad and the youngest one in the country. So that wasn't much of a claim to fame because things got harder the higher I got with the various companies. Anyway, I was swallowed up by Union Pacific and ended up moving to Houston, Texas, where I ran the southern region of the Union Pacific Railroad until 1988, at which point I went to Omaha, Nebraska, which is the headquarters city for that railroad, and helped open and ran the Harriman Dispatching Center, which at the time was the largest centralized dispatching center in the United States. Union Pacific at the time was, it was before it swallowed up the Southern Pacific and the Chicago Northwestern. So it's a much bigger railroad now than then. At that point, I had almost a $1 billion budget, and we ran 800 trains a day. Subsequent to that, I decided to leave the Union Pacific, and I opened a consulting firm in Austin, Texas, and ended up being hired to go to Mexico and help the government identify how to regulate the privatized railroad in Mexico, and did the due diligence for a corporation consortium that wanted to buy one of the privatized trunk lines in Mexico. And in 1990, I wrote those plans and led the team, and in 1997, the consortium I was representing won the major trunk line between Laredo, Texas and Mexico City, and Veracruz and Mexico City. And interestingly enough, Lázaro Cárdenas in Mexico City, so it's by far the heaviest line in Mexico, and I stayed on as the chief operating officer and executed the plan for the privatization of that trunk line. At which point I retired, and in 2001, having most of my retirement money in WorldCom and Enron stock, I went back to work.
Oh, dear.
I had to. I was forced to go back to work and de-retired, and I ended up in as the CEO of the Estonian Railway, which is a very densely railroad, train-populated railroad in Eastern Europe, because the Russian railroad's closest non-freezing port during the Soviet Union days was Tallinn, Estonia, and so it's a very heavily built, the bridges were in marvelous shape and heavily trafficked in coal, grain, and oil products, and I ran that railroad with the idea that the owners, it had been privatized in 2001, the owners wanted to take it public on the Scandinavian and European financial markets. And I had experience doing that with Mexico because I led the bond selling for the consortium to buy the Mexican railroad in the financial markets in Europe, selling junk bonds to buy the railroad. So Kansas City Southern did it. So anyway, I ran that railroad for 3 years. My contract was up. I came back to the United States and started working with a large engineering firm in the United States managing their rail practice. Won two of the major high-speed rail projects while I was doing that. One of them in Wisconsin has since been canceled by the incoming governor, who gave the money back to the federal government. But the one from Chicago to St. Louis that I also won for that engineering firm is under design right now. And I decided I wanted to get back in the railroad business rather than being a railroad supplier, and this job came open, and I competed for it, and it's lucky me because it's a fantastic property and a great staff. We have an engaged board with a lot of experience and a lot of diversity, and this is just a really plum position for me, and I'm so happy to be here. I just can't express myself. It's been a lot of fun so far. I've been doing it for almost 4.5 months now, and it feels like closer to a year because I've been through a budget cycle and all sorts of other things, and here I am and happy to present myself to you as the leader of the Alaska Railroad.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, and let the record also show that Representative Munoz has joined us, and so has Representative Feige, and in the audience is Representative Sadler, and there may be room for you up here if you would like to join us. So we have about 45 minutes for your presentation, so if you want to proceed. And for you that just joined us, if you have any questions as we go along, we're going to ask questions as we go along.
Okay. Well, you should have in front of you there handouts that we brought along with us. We have a December 2010 state report that we sent December 1st. It has some quick facts in there and some of our philosophy going forward. And talks a little bit about our money situation currently and ahead of us. You should have a program of projects summary, which is the major projects which are underway on the railroad and have been underway. And then there is a piece of current news, and it's a 2011 real estate customer service action plan. We have had some criticism at our company over the past year about customer service capabilities and actions of our real estate branch, and so from a timing basis and a current situation basis, I thought it would be good to include those for you to look at in there. So you should have those. I hope you do, and we can go forward with them. I have brought with me three staff members. So, Madam Chair, as we go forward here, if there are any questions, I may deflect some of those to our experts. I have Tom Brooks here, who is our Vice President of Engineering. He's the chief engineer of our company. He's sitting right behind me. Bill O'Leary is our Chief Financial Officer and Vice President of Finance. And Wendy Linskoog is here also, who's our Vice President of Corporate Affairs. And probably most of you know her already. But, I've discovered one thing with Wendy. When you walk across the room at a conference or any place with her, it takes you an hour to get across the room. You meet about 100 people on the way, which is great. Great opportunity for me. Jumping to slide three, for any of you, if I'll make this very brief, but I thought there may be some people that are new or are not familiar with our company, and so we've included in this handout for you in these slides some information about the railroad. Won't dwell on much of it here because I want to get to the questions, but of course we began construction in 1914, finished in 1923. The railroad went on for a while and then was transferred to the federal government to the state in 1985. The architect of that is on our board, and he's sitting behind me also. I think I saw Governor Sheffield come in, but he's one of the architects of that and is still overseeing its health and welfare as we go forward, being a member of our board. In fact, he's vice chairman of our board. We are even though we're a state-owned corporation, we are self-supporting, and we are a full-service railroad serving ports and communities from the Gulf of Alaska to the interior to the Fairbanks area. 469 miles constitutes a small railroad. Oh, thanks. Appreciate it. Thank you. And we have a full-service passenger operation, which runs from Seward to the interior also, and that, of course, is a reduced operation during the winter months and really an active one during the rest of the season in the summer. We are different from other state agencies, and there's only a couple. This is a very busy slide. It's designed for you to take with you, but there's a couple of things I wanted to highlight on it that I think are really important. One, we are an independent state-owned corporation, and we're governed by a seven-member board of directors, which is chartered to. They are assigned to keep us on track with our charter, which requires that we contribute to the economic development of Alaska, and we provide transportation service for passengers and freight in the state. We never take our eye off of that, and we're independent by structure from the 1985 transfer agreement so that we can function like other railroads do in the United States and hit the ground running and be as flexible as possible. We are not covered under the state's Executive Budget Act, which is often an issue here, and we're prepared to talk about that anytime there's any questions about that. The Board of Directors is responsible for initiating both a financial and a performance audit each year. So there's financial oversight as well as operational and capital budget oversight by our board. The board is also assigned the ultimate authority on our land sales. Should they decide to do that, and we work through that as a company, then, of course, it goes to the legislature for final approval if we have any transfers of land or land sales. We are at this particular point in our existence working on, per the legislative requirement from the past session, we are working on a land sale policy, which the board hopes to approve sometime in either the next meeting or the meeting in March. Okay? So you'll be seeing that coming through. Our procurement procedures are required to be substantially equivalent to state procurement requirements, so we adhere to that very closely. We're also subject to the executive ethics code. We submit an annual report with audited financial statements to the state, and we're required by law to adopt a long-range capital improvement plan each year, and we share that plan with the legislature. The railroad, this next slide, slide six, lists some of the things we do at the company. I won't go through each one, but I direct your attention to the box at the bottom, which indicates that we create about 3,000 jobs with our business throughout the rail belt and $150 million in payroll across the state, in addition, of course, to supporting the industries that use our company for passenger service and or freight movement. The slide on page 7 breaks down our revenue. It's an important slide to understand about our company. It's a hybrid railroad. It's very different than the other railroads you read about in the newspaper, the big class ones and some of the other regional railroads. These are preliminary unaudited results, but they're fairly standard percentages. Our revenue is 67% freight, 17% passenger, and 15% real estate, and then a small amount of other stuff. So passenger and real estate almost equal to half of the revenue, but not quite. Thank you. I keep forgetting to do that. Okay. Moving on to slide 8, our freight business. This past year, we moved 6.3 million tons of freight. That makes us a regional railroad in 2010, compared to 6.2 the year before, so about even. We expect that to grow by about 3.5% in this coming year. We moved just under 1 million tons of export coal in 2010 and anticipate moving 1.1. In fact, in a meeting with Usabelli Coal yesterday, we'll probably grow that up to close to 1.3 million in 2011. So that's great news for us.
Now, Chris,
yes.
With the your anticipated 3.5% this year, and that doesn't count that contract with the coal company, so what is your anticipation, anticipated increase for this year?
Well, it'll be, from a percentage standpoint, it'll be small because we do anticipate the 1.1, but we expect it to go up to about 1.3. So let's say it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.9%.
Well, what I meant was, is that going to be because more people are using you or?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, what that is the coal market is, the export coal market in the world right now is really hot. Use a fair amount of the vernacular anyway, not only from a demand standpoint, but from a price standpoint. And part of that is currently due to the flooding in Australia, which has wiped out some mines that shipped coal to Korea and China. And we have the right kind of coal for the needs in those countries, and Usabelli has identified that the demand can increase, and so we are working together to identify with given resources we have now how much we can move, and Usabelli will sell up to that level, and we'll work together as a partnership to grow that going forward. We expect it to continue growing like that, Madam Chairman, for the next several years at least, and we expect the price to drop because the demand will come back, or the supply will come back eventually. You know, Australia will come back and the mines will be back. We expect the price and the demand to stay at a regular increase instead of this splurge, if you want to call it now, for the foreseeable future, 10, 20 years.
Wonderful.
Okay.
And let the record show that Senator Menard has joined us.
Okay, this next one is an important one also. This shows how our freight revenue is split up. And if you'll notice, we're very dependent on a small number of commodity groups. Petroleum by itself, which is basically Flint Hills as a client, is 28% of our revenue. Coal export is 12%, and if you add the coal, it shuttles back and forth from the Healy mine to the Fairbanks area and the military bases in that part of the interior. You put the two together, it's 22% of our business. So there is 50% of our business in just basically two clients, the coal company and Flint Hills. That's a good thing and a bad thing. It makes us fragile, potentially fragile, based on what happens going forward to those clients. We also have about a 30% cut of our revenue in the barge service. We run between Tacoma and Whittier and occasionally to Seward. This time of year, there are barges that go to Seward. And that's consumer products and other things that come up into the interior and up to the Anchorage area. Then we have smaller percentages in gravel and TOFC and COFC that move in gravel in the Anchorage area and the rest from the Anchorage area up to the interior.
What does TOFC and COFC stand for?
I'm sorry. Those are railroad terms. TOFC is trailers on flat cars, so it's just a truck trailer that would normally have a truck cab in front of it pulling it. Instead, it's loaded onto a flat car and is pulled by a train. So basically, when you have a train load of TOFC traffic and you might have 40 trailers on there, that's 40 trucks that aren't on the road, that kind of a, okay. COFC is the same thing, but containers rather than wheeled trailers.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Passenger business, we're proud of the passenger business. We have done some things to improve it this coming year. We're excited about it. We've put back on our onboard tour guides. We're excited about what we see. We have a great response so far this year, better than we've had in a long, long time from an advanced reservation standpoint. Anyway, this past year we moved 405,000 passengers compared to 471,000 in 2009, which was a 14% decrease. Partially almost completely economy driven, and of course affected greatly by the fact that some cruise ships stopped coming to Alaska during that period. And we're anticipating some of that to come back this year, like I said, and next year the cruise ships are coming back again. Princess is running another one, and and some others. The governor may tell you about some of the cruise ship business that's coming to the Port of Anchorage, too.
Representative Groenberg.
Thank you. Do you have a plan B? What to do if now or in the future the cruise ships stop sending as many people? Do you have a plan to work directly with the airlines?
We have had many strategy sessions about that. Maybe I should have said this at the beginning of this presentation. I elected to come here and learn the business, learn the geography, the topography, the staff, and I spent the first 3.5 months doing that, traveling the railroad and meeting employees on the ground, and rather than coming in and saying, okay, at this company we're going to do this and we're going to do that. So we have postponed the strategy planning under my administration of this railroad until right now. We're starting a series of meetings in-house with the management team to come up with a strategy to recommend to the board. And we'll have a board strategy brainstorming session on the 17th of February, at which point I'll be able to let all of you know what our strategy for the company is going forward. I don't have one yet. However, in our early thinking, where one of our key strategies in both the passenger area and the freight area is to find a way to diversify our income for the health going forward. On the freight side, if we were to lose Flint Hills because of oil price or the pipeline volume dropping or whatever, we would be in a serious situation. So we need to expand our existing customers' use of the railroad and find other clients. So we will have a strategy directed at that, and we'll have a similar strategy directed at the passenger service. And it will involve the airlines, it involves marketing in the lower 48 and internationally for our own offerings that aren't connected with the cruise ships. So the answer is yes. It's just not defined yet how we would do it.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, in 2011, we expect about a 3.2% passenger growth over 2010. Real estate, this is a really important part of this railroad because we own about just short of 40,000 acres at the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Some of that is right-of-way railroad that's involved completely with the operation of the railroad, and some of it is not. Anyway, our department includes property development of some of that property, leases and permits for people wanting to cross the railroad, use the right-of-way for something, or lease our property for businesses. We have dockage and wharfage. Like at Whittier and Seward, where we charge for ships to dock, and we get income from that. And we have a facilities maintenance and management department associated with that generates some income also. The important thing about this real estate department is 69% of our corporate net income. Now, I'm saying net income. You already saw that the revenue is only 15%, but 69% of our corporate net income is derived from this real estate department. Very important. Without the real estate department, the Alaska Railroad Corporation is not self-sustaining in its current form. And that was the reason that the property in 1985, came to the railroad, is that very reason. We'll shift to capital funding sources. We use our own earnings. This is necessary, and we have to provide required match for federal funds, and we do get federal funds. I'll cover that in a minute. And it's also essential for funding our freight-related improvements. We also get money from the USDOT, the Federal Transit Administration. We get formula funds. We're a 60% grantee. In other words, we're not a complete transit operation. We also have freight, but we're funded at 60% of the other railroads under the formula. We have a 20% ARRC match required. We have money involved in some of our special projects and some for security projects from other agencies that you see listed on there. Important to note that federal funds allocated to the Alaska Railroad do not affect federal funding for other state transportation projects. They're completely independent of it. And the federal match is not from the State of Alaska General Fund. It comes from our earnings. Some other budget highlights. And Uncle Bill, as we call him, is behind me there. If we have any detailed questions, he's happy to answer. Even if he's not happy to answer them, he will. Financial snapshot in 2010, we had budgeted net earnings of $8.4 million with a $4.3 million loss from train operations. Important to note. Our preliminary numbers, not audited yet, looks to us like we're going to have earnings of $13.7 million. Thank you. 700,000 of which is lost from train, or 700,000 lost from train operations. So, in other words, 2010 has come in a lot better than we thought it was. And that's good news, because when we move on to the next page, which is that one. We have
Chris,
a much better story.
Chris,
yes.
When if you go back to that the previous slide, the budgeted net earnings was 8.4, but there was a 4.3 million loss from train operations. Was that because of decreased passengers?
Decreased passengers, and Flint Hills traffic was lower, and anything pipeline related was lower last year.
Okay, but it was better than you thought, and you're going to show us that the next
year. Yeah, it was better than we thought, and it's going to be better next year. Okay. So we had a net loss on quarter train operations from 2006 to 2010. And our net earnings rely on real estate for stability and sustainability. We also have a fairly fragile financial situation because we're dependent, like I said, on a couple of big customers. We have Flint Hills. They are projecting growth this year, and we're excited about that, so we've built their entire forecast into our budget. But we got off to a real rocky start in January with the pipeline shutting down and it affected Flint Hills. So we also expect in 2011 to export coal to have strong global demand. I already talked about that. It's tempered by some potential environmental issues in Seward, but we're working hard on that issue. And like I said, we expect that to grow instead of to diminish. So we're really strong on working on building that business just to help protect the company from any Flint Hills failure to come through in the forecast there. We see moderate passenger growth, and we see some increase in costs, especially in fuel and benefits, which kind of goes with the territory. To a certain extent, they're out of our control. But we do see an earnings budget of $18.2 million, which the board has approved. So we have a budget that will produce $18.2 million in net earnings. And we have contingency plans in place that we, inside the company, call off-ramps that we can take to make sure that if I did it again. Obviously, they didn't hire me for my skill in keeping up with the slides.
Yeah.
Is that the right one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Down at the bottom, where am I? Oh, back here. The contingency plans are in place if revenue doesn't materialize. It's the bottom line on that last slide. We have what we call offerings. And if we have a reduction in revenue on either the passenger side or the freight side, we can take some off-ramps from an operating cost standpoint, and we have our budget for this coming year, our capital budget, tiered and phased by season and by segments of the year. If the revenue doesn't come through, then we will take those off-ramps. We almost did it in January, unfortunately, but we had a military move that made up some of the loss in Flint Hills, and some of our other business looked really good, some other special moves. We haven't had to take any off-ramps yet. We don't expect to, but we do have them in there where we can protect the budget and stay sustainable should the revenue forecast not come to fruition. Okay? From the capital budget standpoint, this sounds like a lot, and it is. And when you see how it's funded, you'll recognize how we can do it. We have a $63.4 million new spending capital budget for 2011. $25 million of that approximately comes from our own cash flow, from our own earnings. We have 20.4 from Formula FTA funds with a railroad match of 9% included. We have 13.6 million from Federal Transit Administration bond proceeds, and we have 4.3 million from other sources, small grants from federal emergency, from FEMA and from USDOT. Stimulus fund type grant. Highlights of that, we have a sixth year of a seven-year major accelerated track rehabilitation program we've been going through, and I'm delighted to report that coming in as an objective third-party reporter, so to speak, to all of you, the money has been spent well and wisely and in the right places, and we have a very stable, very safe railroad. The slide, I didn't catch it, I apologize. Shows the focus thing on it between Anchorage and Fairbanks. We are just this year switching to spending some of the money south of Anchorage between Anchorage and Seward. But the focus over the first 6 years for sure has been, 5.5 years actually, has been on that portion from Anchorage to Fairbanks. And those were easily the biggest challenges we had from a track quality and safety standpoint. We have an unfunded federal mandate of positive train control. We're working on that. In fact, we're probably the leader in the industry on how far along we are with positive train control. And for those of you who are not sure what or don't remember what that is, it's a sort of a safe gap measure electronically that allows a potential accident to be taken out of the hands of the engineer and a train stopped automatically should that become necessary. It's very expensive, but it has to do and was mandated by federal law a couple of years ago because of that horrible accident in Southern California at Chatsworth where the freight train and the passenger train got together and killed a number of people. So anyway, we have to fund that. It's an expensive project, and we're ongoing with it now. We have bridge rehabilitation we have to stay up with. We don't have any bridges other than a couple that require immediate attention that are in our plan this year. So we're not one of the railroads you see, regional railroads, that have impending disaster out there because of bridge deterioration. We're a pretty strong railroad from that standpoint. And our funding for all of these is phased, like I said, just like the operating budget, and we'll take the off-ramps, and we won't do these projects should we not come up with the revenue. Okay? Now, moving on to project news. In your slide there, and they got the full-page slides, did they not here? All one page instead of the, yeah, I see they did. That map is a useful one. It shows where our projects are. It's a drawing of the railroad, and in the boxes, there's some general information. You also have the project report that is in there that should cover most of the things you see in there. So this is a good thing to have in your desk and for the staff to have, because as we talk forward going through the legislative session this year, you see our reports throughout the year and at the end of this year in December. It'll reflect information that you see about these projects on this page. There's a couple of them that we would like to highlight. This first one is Northern Rail Extension, the NRE. It's part of an 80-mile line between North Pole and Delta Junction, but it's a much smaller segment of that, and it's a bridge at Salsha across the Tanana River. And it is currently seeking approval through the Corps of Engineers in the STB process. And there's several things about this bridge that are important that we'll be talking to you about. This project is to be accomplished in four phases. Phase one is the bridge that we're talking about. And the status of that project is this. The design is 90% complete. We have a CMGC contractor on board that's been working with us for how long now, Tom?
About 8 months.
CMCG
is?
Construction Management General Contractor.
And that particular model allows the contractor to come on board with no guarantee they end up with the work ultimately, but they work with us during the design process. And at the end of the day, you end up with a project that is constructible, basically. At which point you can negotiate with that contractor on a price and probably come up with a guaranteed maximum price, or you can go back out on the street and rebid the entire thing. But what it does is ensure that the design is constructible. Okay. That's what it accomplishes. The estimated cost of this bridge at this particular point is plus or minus $185 million. And the costs have escalated since you first heard about this bridge for a variety of reasons, one of which is increased levee costs in the design for several different reasons that Tom can go into more detail on if you'd like to. Permitting required additional scope, such as side channel bridges, as well as additional engineering. And there's been a large degree during this past summer of river erosion. In fact, since I came, first time I saw the bridge and the second time I went by, after I'd been here about 2 months, that the bank had already moved about, I'd say, 10, 15 feet. Yeah, so it's a moving target. It's a very sensitive target, and that's a wild river in a wild part of the state. Anyway, the current funding for this project is a 2008 DOD FRA grant of $44.2 million, which expires in 2013. Another one that is $60 million, which expires in 2014. $40 million state funding, of which I'm sure you're familiar, which expires, actually the five-year cycle on it runs out in 2015. Expires may be the wrong word, but something would have to be done to extend it. And that gives us a total of $144.2 million allotted to this project. And you'll notice the estimated cost is $185 million, plus or minus. So there's a funding gap in there. We have some efforts to make sure that we get to construction on this project. The railroad is the project manager. It's endorsed by the state and by the military, and the railroad has accepted the project management of this project because it is an important piece of the economic development of Alaska, because of the military connection and the ultimate corridor to Delta Junction from the Fairbanks area. We need to find additional funding. The shortfall is estimated at $20 to $60 million, depending on bridge revision. We have been in dialogue with the military, who suggested that we could maybe find a different way to phase this project and take some money out of the original design of the project. So we're working hard on that right now, and hope to have that done by middle of February. We're also in the middle right now, and that will let us identify just more exactly what the funding gap is. We will take some money out of the project, and once we get approval from the EPA, assuming we do, which is the next issue I'll talk to you about it, we'll have something that we can come to the legislature with and show exactly what the number is. But we don't have it today. We know it's somewhere between 20 and 60, and we're hoping it's on the low end of that.
Chris, can you just very briefly just explain what a side channel bridge is?
Okay. I'd love to, but I'm going to lateral this to our running back.
Okay.
The Tenaya River.
State course, your name, please.
Oh, I'm Tom Brooks, Alaska Railroad Chief Engineer. The Tenaya River has a main channel, and it also is a braided river, so it has channels that run back in the woods. Our original design that we talked about last year assumed that we would span the main channel, and the side channels we put in culverts to provide local relief. They don't carry a volume of flow, so they're not important for flood control reasons. But after the EIS, in the last year, we've worked with the permitting agencies to get permits from Fish and Game, Corps of Engineers, all of that, have a long dialogue about exactly how you're going to do that. And they've identified those side channels as an important place that we would have to put bridges. So some of our scope increase has been the difference between culverts and bridges, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of a factor of 10 to 100, depending on where you're at. So that has had an impact on costs.
I lived in Tok for 4 years, and going back and forth between Tok and Fairbanks, that river changes every year. It's just amazing, and it's so braided, so it is amazing. So I can see why that you'd have to do that.
Right.
Okay, Representative Feige.
Sir, you say side channels. Which side of the river are we talking about?
The two main side channels that we talked to the agencies about are on the south bank of the river. I'm not sure they're on the map in any detail.
No.
Actually, they are. They're in the page. I'm not sure what page it is. Page 20. There are the boundary slough marked and then a BB slough. Yeah, in the lower right there. Yeah, boundary slough and BB slough. And part of what we're working with the military on is to see if we can get them to put in those bridges. And basically, we would come out and build the embankment to either side, and then they would come in later, put in a bridge that was capable for their needs. And then, in a later phase, when the railroad gets there, we would put in the railroad bridge. And those are some of the kinds of things we're trying to do with them.
Why don't you just finish with this portion of the presentation?
If you'll run the projector,
I'll get it.
So getting to construction, we currently have a struggle with the EPA over the permits themselves. The Corps of Engineers, I have to get too far down in the details here, but the Corps of Engineers is actually the agent for the EPA to administer the Clean Water Act, commonly known as wetlands permits. And the EPA has not like this project. They sent some letters along back in December to the Corps. The Corps has asked us to respond. We've done that, and we're waiting for the Corps' decisions about how to move ahead here. We're fairly confident that what the EPA is trying to do is really off base, and that the Corps will decide to go ahead and issue us permits. Having said that, I'd say also the DPA is able to then appeal to higher levels in the Corps and eventually take on the project review themselves. So we're quite interested in what's going on there and quite active in doing that and taking a fairly strong stance, because we feel what the EPA is doing is really trying to subvert the environmental impact statement process. They're questioning things that happened a long time ago in the EIS project and decisions that were made quite some time ago. And then once we have permits and we have the funding gap filled, we need to go to our funding agencies, particularly the Federal Railroad Administration, who has our $100 million in grants. DOD essentially passed the funding over to them, the federal end of things. And like, as you would expect, the FRA wants to be able to see that our project is going to be completed and see a funding package that will assure that that happens. They will build a $140 million bridge and then stop $20 to $60 million short. So we have to show them a project financing plan that shows that the bridge is completed. And then, of course, our board also wants to see that all of that occurs. And the financial situation at the railroad is such that we really can't contribute.
So the funding, the timing of this is really important. Like Tom said, the funding is needed by early summer 2011, and the reason it's critical is if we don't solve the EPA thing and don't close the funding gap and we have to delay the construction of the beginning of the construction of the bridge, then we will not have time to spend the federal money by the time it expires, and we'll lose the money up front. So the deadline for this is this summer. We have to resolve this one way or the other. Our board of directors will be forced into a no-go decision. We're hoping that doesn't happen, but that's what we're faced with right now. It is what it is. The next one is Port McKenzie Rail Extension. Again, we're the project manager on behalf of the borough for this. It is a rail project. It's to construct a 30 to 45 mile rail line to connect the port to the main line of our railroad. The Surface Transportation Board is currently responsible for U.S. rail extensions, and they are working on, we'll go to the next one here, approving. They're working on conducting the environmental impact study, and we're hopeful that we'll get a positive ruling from them here sometime by the end of February. We actually expected it about 3 or 4 months ago. But they are also, interestingly enough, involved in selecting the line. There are three alternatives, and the STB was asked to pick which one they wanted done, which one they thought had the least impact, and then it was approved. And once we know what that is, we can proceed with the project. I don't know if any of you had a chance to go to the site, but down where, right at the port where the loop is going to be, that will ultimately handle coal trains and other things. The grading is all done, and it's just waiting to have the railroad put on it. And then, of course, the line from that particular endpoint down there to the main line of us is just a dream at this particular point. There's no work that's been done there.
And we are going to have a report on Fort McKenzie next week.
That's correct. Yeah. Project is ready to begin right away acquisition and construction as soon as we know what that line is for sure. And the state legislature appropriated $27.5 million 2007-2008 to fund an EIS and $37 million 2010 to begin design and construction. And I believe at this particular point the governor's placeholder budget is $20 million for this year.
Yes.
I believe that's correct.
And
yes.
Well, while we have a little lull here, Representative Les Guerra is online listening in. So
okay.
Just wanted to recognize him.
That's Fort McKenzie. Any questions that Tom can elaborate on in connection with Fort McKenzie? Okay. We have some statewide issues that are important to the railroad. We believe that the continued existence of the North Pole Refinery is a critical component to the state's energy picture and is a mainstay of our revenue stream. I've already covered that. That's just a slide you can take with you. It is really important to the ongoing stability of our company as this North Pole Refinery revenue. We are working hard to find alternatives. through other companies, existing clients, like I said, or new clients, and we'll continue to work on that just because it's good business. But as it stands right now, if we were to lose that North Pole refinery, we'd have to change the texture of the railroad drastically. Next one. Executive Budget Act. This comes up periodically. There's some slides to take with you. If this is an issue later in the legislature, glad to come back and talk about it further. We believe that the 1985 design of the railroad is the sensible one. I do especially believe that it's the sensible design for the management of this company and the legal structure of the company to keep it resilient enough to survive, and that we do have to compete for clients. And so anyway, that's a slide to take with you. The sale of our lands, this is an ongoing issue. As I said, this is a board topic as much as anything. We have a real estate committee on the board, and then the full board is that has passed on a draft of a land sale policy consistent with HB 357 from 2010. That's continuing for review. We are collecting for the board all of the feedback from our existing leaseholders and the public. That plan is posted on our website. It was mailed to a lot of the local legislators and to all of our leaseholders, and we are collecting all of that feedback on that, ideas for that rule. The board will give those to the board, and the board will consider this rule, and ultimately it's their decision on whether to change it or what to suggest to the legislature as the ongoing policy.
Chris,
yes,
I know somewhere along the line, if there's sale of land, the legislature has to okay it, but I don't know if that's any land or a certain amount or.
No, and the way it works is the land was transferred to the ownership of the railroad in 1985. It's almost 40,000 acres. I think it's 38,000 or something, 36,000 acres. And should we agree to sell it, or the board, and the board approves it, or the board decides to sell it, and it passes through the usual business structure at our board, and it goes to the legislature, whether it's transfer or a sale, regardless of the size.
Right. Okay.
Ultimately, it is state land, even though we own it. We are a state company, and it is state land, so it has to be out. Any transfer of ownership has to go through the state.
Okay, thank you.
Seward coal loading facility. This is an extremely important piece of our business and very important to the economy of Alaska. And all of our export coal at this particular point goes through the Seward facility, which is owned by, is operated by Aurora, which is a subsidiary of Usabelli. We do have some issues there. It's a facility that's been operating since 1984 as a public-private facility. We acquired it with federal funds in 2003. We've spent close to $1.5 million on safety, efficiency, and environmental improvements since 2003, and we have additional expenditures planned for this year, 2011. We do have some issues going on. We're continuing to work with DEC and the community to mitigate dust, as you can see in here, and it is an ongoing problem. We have worked on some supplemental environmental projects, which we have completed, which are designed to further reduce dust emission. That's foggers, places where the coal is wetted down. Additionally, inside where they go on to the where the coal goes onto the belts, there's an effort that's in place already. It's one of the SEPs to reduce dust emissions there. We still do get some that blows around, and we're going to continue to work on that along with Usability. We are currently involved in a Clean Water Act lawsuit as fellow defendants along with Usability Coal. That we're vigorously fighting because we don't believe that we think we had the proper permit to operate that coal facility since its inception, even before we owned it, and so does Usability. In any event, there is a lawsuit going there. The worst thing that could happen is we lose the lawsuit and the ability to operate that facility, and there is no more export coal out of Alaska. It's just that simple. So. Next one. Vegetation management. This is extremely important to us and extremely important to all of our employees, as are all these other things we just talked about. But we have one of the worst problems I've ever seen of vegetation affecting our right-of-way, our ability to keep our ballast clean enough where we keep the surface of our track, the walkways good enough for employee safety. especially in snow times. You can't see the weeds underneath the ground. Anyway, we have a terrible weed problem in this railroad, and we've been unable to spray for weed control like all the other railroads do in the United States until just this past year. And we're thankful we finally got a permit to do that, and we did spray down in the area from Seward to Indian, which is one of our stations on the line between Anchorage and Seward. And we have already applied for herbicide permits this year to do Anchorage Rail Yard in the Fairbanks and Healy areas. And I believe there's a slide in here that maybe it's the next one that shows you some of the differences and what happens. The one on the upper right there is a what happens after you spray. And you'll notice it's a very controlled spray pattern. Because of the history of the issues here in Alaska, we have chosen this small spray pattern, whereas if you were to go see some of the other railroads in the lower 48, you would find the spray pattern much wider because the weeds rapidly grow in, you know, into the vacuum where there aren't any others. Anyway, that's important to us, and it's important that the legislators know it's important to us. The FR, Federal Railway Administration, has levied about $500,000 of fines against us for our lack of weed control because we haven't been able to spray. And they're currently in abeyance because of this program. We're now making progress, but we have approved those, and they're in our books, and we're hopeful to someday get them off by continuing this strategic program. Madam Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I hope it was useful, and we're happy to answer any more questions. The governors are really going to be angry with me. I promised you I'd be done 2 minutes ago. I didn't get there.
Anyway. Any questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Since you do have a close working relationship with Yusa Valley, I'm sure you're aware of their wish to, or their potential to open a coal mine in the Wishbone Hill area.
Yes.
One of the big impacts, local impacts to that area, if that mine were to go into production, be about 100 coal trucks a day, perhaps. Transiting along the highway, which mixed in with other traffic may or may not have a significant effect on the local traffic patterns. Is there the possibility of building a rail spur following the existing Alaska Railroad right-of-way that you guys own into the Sutton area, or at least close to the mine site? Is that possible, or is that simply economically out of the question?
No, it's something we would like to do. We did retain the right-of-way, even though there were some modifications and some beautification projects that took place through Palmer. We still have the right-of-way, which gets us up to how close to the...
Within about 2 miles.
Within about 2 miles of where the mine's actually going to be operating, so there'd be some truck movement down to the railhead. We're prepared to operate. What you're talking about is instead of 100 trucks a week or whatever the number was you just said, you'd be talking about two trains, really, is what... go through Palmer rather than instead of the truck. But it's dependent upon a guaranteed contract going forward. We can't afford to build it. It's a fairly expensive project, and we can't afford to build into Palmer just in case Yusa Valley wants to use us. So it's dependent upon their analysis, which they told us last night in the same meeting I was talking about that they would have done in September. Depending on their analysis, whether or not we will proceed with that project from a rail standpoint. If they decide that it's more convenient for them and more economical to sell our product and get it to Port McKenzie by truck, then, of course, we won't build the rail spur in there. Okay. So that's where that stands. So stay tuned, and we'll see what happens by September. Okay.
Was there someone else over here that had their hand up?
Okay, Madam Chairman. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Nope.
Sorry.
Representative Thomas. Senator Thomas has got a question.
Thank you for your thorough report. I'm looking at slide 7 with the real estate. Your real estate always intrigues me. 15%, is that gross? That must be gross because you had another number in here that was 67% of net.
It sure is.
Obviously a very different operation in either side, so that makes a huge difference. And with that thought in mind, that is 60-some percent of your 67%, I think, was the number later in the. Have you done a cost-benefit analysis of both extensions of the rail, similar to the question you were just talking about here? You have to get a contract in hand before you would, or not in hand necessarily, but at least a commitment in hand before you would build this rail extension in Sutton, yet the 80 mile to Delta and the McKenzie one, which are going to be extremely expensive projects. Do you have a cost-benefit analysis of how that works out?
No. On the Tanana River Bridge, there is no rate of return to the railroad in the foreseeable future.
Right.
There's no incremental revenue that flows to the railroad for that project. This project is part of an overall economic development plan working for the future, with the military being the immediate beneficiary. So from our standpoint, it is purely a cost project. We're happy to participate in it because of our charter, and we're also obligated to maintain it and operate it going forward, which would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 a year, unless there was a large problem of some sort that we'd also have to fund. But there is no rate of return project that we have done as a company, because there is no rate of return for the railroad.
And don't get me wrong, I think the railroad is a crucial link in the state's transportation system, no doubt in my mind. But as I look at the projects and we look at revenue, and you look at the potential for Flint Hills closing up, you know, we hope that doesn't happen. Obviously, we'd like to do a variety of things to ensure that they stay there, or make sure that if they want to go, somebody else maybe takes that plant over. These are big projects, and when I look at it, I do my own back of the napkin kind of estimate of what 80 miles of railroad costs, and I use your numbers with projects that I don't think you're particularly in favor of. So those projects, so maybe it's cheaper really than I anticipate using your numbers for the ones you don't want. If we got down to the bottom of it and said, what is it really going to cost to build, you know, some of the other realignment in the Fairbanks area or something like that. So I guess, and I won't take up the time here because there are other people, I'd like to talk with you about those concepts, because if we don't have anything other than potential anticipation that there would be resource development between North Pole and Delta to justify a extremely expensive 80 miles, there's another bridge or two in that same project that are probably the same number as maybe this single one across the Tanana, because you're out crossing the Tanana again, or the Good Pasture River coming back across. So they're big projects. And I would just like to, you know, feel some more of a comfort level with those projects when we are potentially having something that has no necessarily our identified revenue.
Okay, so. Be happy to meet with you separately about that.
Good, thank you.
And I don't see any other questions, so we thank you very much for your presentation. And I'm going to have a brief at ease to let the other groups set up. However, before I do that, we have someone in our midst that is going to be leaving us soon, and she's our legislative liaison for DOT, and her name is Mary Shiroki. And for the rest of us that have worked with her, we know how invaluable she is to us. So, Mary, we really want to just say we're going to miss you something awful, and we really, really appreciate it. Stand up, please. And we really appreciate you. We love you, and we hate that you're going to be going, but somebody else's gain is our loss. So we just wanted to let you know that we really cared, and thank you so much for what you've done for us.
Which I very, very frequently forget. I have thoroughly enjoyed the transportation committees for the last 5 years, and this is amazing. So thank all of you, and I will be working with all of you still, just for a different agency. And in the short term, DOT is working to get the positions filled, but please send your information and your requests to me. We don't have specific names yet, so I think it'll be about a month before things are really settled over at DOT, and I'll just make sure things get handled till then. But thank you. This is amazing.
Thank you, Mary. Okay, let's have a brief at ease. bring the meeting back to order. We want to make sure we have as much time as we can to hear about the Governor Sheffield and what he has to share with us. So about the Port of Anchorage. So, Governor, if you could proceed and bring us up to date about this important expansion project of the port.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Sheffield, Director of the Port of Anchorage. And I think I'm a bit reminded to tell you that you have four slides in addition to what we sent out to begin with. And so I don't know if you have them in order or not, but if I can, I'll have the same problem that Chris did, remembering to turn this slide over every time that I get through with it here. So otherwise, if I don't use my notes here, I'd talk forever. So.
Okay. Well, Governor.
And some of you already know that.
You know, we've all seen the articles in the Anchorage Daily News about the challenges that you're having, and so are you going to be able to go over some of that with us?
I will.
Good.
I'm going to go over that in about the middle of my presentation. You're going to get more than you wanted probably of that. So
go ahead and proceed. If anybody has questions, we'll.
I think I know everyone here pretty well. Except Representative Peterson, I don't know you too well, but I know that you're a former Peace Corps volunteer, so that makes you a pretty good guy. And we met before, and I know the family art story, of course. So, anyway, thanks for inviting me to be here today. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important and essential project of Port of Anchorage. I was in Fairbanks the other day talking to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, and I said, really, it's up here, it's the Port of Fairbanks, because everything that you get basically comes through the port down there, so it's really the airport. So the Port of Anchorage is vital to Alaska's economy. And as you can see by the cover slide that you probably have in front of you, you know, the lower right-hand corner is a pipe ship. We had six or seven or eight of those this year. Some of the pipe went to Liberty Field, another went to redo some wells and maybe connections. And bottom left is the military photo. We've had almost 30 deployments for Afghanistan and Iraq in the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. Above that is a cruise ship that we have every Monday. Last year, this year, the same ship will be there, only be on every Friday. We don't know about 2012 yet. Above that is a cement ship that delivers cement 8 or 9 times a year to Anchorage, and it gets taken out to all over Alaska except for Southeast. One on the right is a big propane tank that went to Fairbanks by way of two trucks, and that was about 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know if that went on to Prudhoe Bay or stayed in Fairbanks, but maybe somebody could help me out with that. Anyway, so that's a little bit about the, I think I got the wrong one. Oh, I'm hitting the wrong button, you see. I remembered to hit it, but I got the wrong one. Okay, so the next slide is a map of Alaska, and if you look on there on the right-hand side, you'll see Anchorage, and our ships come in from Tacoma. Two ships, both Totem Ocean Trader and Horizon Lines, come in twice a week, Sundays and Tuesdays, both of them at the same time. And container freight, everything you buy in a grocery store and or clothes in Walmart or whatever comes in that way, and then it gets distributed to Western Alaska by tug and barge. It goes out by airplane. It goes out by truck all over South Central Alaska. It goes by railroad to up to Fairbanks. three times a week, and so it's a I like to say we're kind of a meat and potato fort. We bring in all the food for 85% of the state. We bring in all the fuel. Everything you wear comes through the port. So no matter what happens in Alaska, we go up and down with the workforce in Alaska, like the railroad does, and by certain things happening. But unless everybody leaves Alaska, we'll still be doing the same thing. We'll be delivering food and fuel and gasoline and everything you use and all the heating oil. So it is an important port. And I'll kind of get into some other values there in a moment. Did I do it right? Okay. Wait. There it is. The next slide is on our container goods. We have an average of 120,000 containers a year coming through the port. That's not much compared to L.A., Long Beach, or New York, New Jersey. But all ports do the same thing. They just, some of them are busier, have more tonnage, and have more income, and so on and so forth. And I've already talked about the food and the automobiles. We get about 55,000 automobiles through the port every year. And I know that sounds enormous, and it is. But and our low 2 years ago was about 35,000. This year we're back up to around 43. So you can see that our port is about 4% busier this last year than we were the year before. We had 360 ship landings in 2009, and we had 505 landings in 2010. So you can see things are increasing. That's cement ships and cruise ships and pipe ships and a lot of fuel that Flintails used to haul in by rail, but now it's coming in from Asia by tanker. I think get to the next one. There we go. Okay. We about 11 million barrels of fuel annually, and that's comes in by tugs and barges from Valdez. Mostly the fuel that comes in from Valdez goes to Elmendorf Air Force Base. It's JP-8 jet fuel, and then Flint Hills comes down with jet fuel for the Anchorage Airport, for the Ted Stevens International Airport. And heating oils, which is another form of jet fuel. We also get some Air Force brings in tankers from wherever they can get the fuel, and military tankers for Elmendorf. The airport brings in a lot more jet fuel from Asia. And Flint Hills is thinking now about competing for price on that, and so they may well be gearing up and bringing down more fuel by rail. That helps, doesn't make any difference to us. It's about the same amount of tonnage for us, but it helps the railroad, since they used to bring down about 130 tank cars a day, and now it's about 30 to 75. So you can see the difference that the railroad has to deal with. Military support, railroad talked about the bridge across the Tanawha River to open up 1 million acres or so of training grounds, and then if that happened and the rail line went in eventually, then you could go on to the missile site or something like that. That's probably in another life, but as far as the missile site and taking the railroad to Canada, I always wanted to run a railroad to the Arctic, And as far as my vision went, well, the Hippo wanted to take it on to Siberia, you know, and I couldn't get that far. But these things are, some of these things are in the, were in the future.
Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Governor. What does it legally mean to be designated a national strategic seaport?
Good. Thank you for that question. The Department of Defense does that because we have 25 acres of ground ready on a 24-hour basis to store military equipment to go in or out on a ship at a moment's notice, you might say, for any place in the world. And so we guarantee that. And we're on a strategic port, whether we guarantee it or not, because we serve the five military bases in Alaska. And all of the Stryker Brigade, there's one in Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks, and the Stryker Brigade at Fort Richardson in Anchorage. And between those two bases, we've had up to 3,500 pieces of equipment moved at one time. That would be two ships, two Navy ships, or one contract ship and a Navy ship coming in. And all that equipment is stored down in the port, and they were able to move it pretty fast. Back on that slide of the, I'm going to show you on a facing slide here a little bit. A road that we built from the port up to Cherry Hill, which is an area on Elmendorf Air Force Base, right behind the port, up on the hill. And then we built the road another 5 miles on out to the north end of North-South Runway. And that's where we get all of our gravel for our phasing. But the military uses that, the Port Rich uses that road to bring that equipment down to the port now. So they don't have to go down the highway and across the bridge at 1 mile an hour and hold up traffic for days or hours into the port. So they like to say they got a port in the backyard, and basically they really do. And on the Fort Wainwright, all that equipment comes down the train and comes right into the port now because we put a rail line into the back of the port. So we're really truly it's a good deal for the military. It's a good deal for us. We got the gravel from them because we save about $140 million just on gravel. Because gravel doesn't cost much, just the transportation. So, thank you for that. The military is very important. If they, we serve the five military bases, and they're very happy with the service that we give them. 2010, review, I told you about the additional ship calls. We had our first major cruise ship ever to come in into the Anchorage port on a regular basis last year. They'll be here again this year. Instead of Mondays, they'll be calling on us on Fridays. It's good for Anchorage. It's good for our resume. It's good for revenue. They were very happy. We don't know about 2012 yet. I think it depends upon how many marketing calls they get for the ships this year. We'll make their determination if they're going to come in again in 2012. So we hope that works. It also depends upon the budget that the state has to give for the tourism business and their promotion. So I want to mention that because that's they gear their ships on that, and they gear it on customer comments. So if they don't like Homer, they don't go to Homer anymore. If they don't like Juneau, they don't go to Juneau anymore. So they're pretty sharp operators, and people like to travel with them. Our expansion project adds a slip for the cruise ships down on the south end, which I'll show you again here pretty soon. This slide is before and after, we call it. The before is the above. Of course, it's a shorter course. The after is shows the length and the width of it. It expands the length. We're adding 130 acres of ground on the right side and on the left side. And that coupled with 125 acres we already had. It's a big project, and that little picture up on the right-hand side is kind of part of the reason we started this. That is one of our pilings. We have thousands of pile in our docks now with trestles going across to the actual dock. And when I got there, and they were holes in them, or you could put your fist through them. So we spent millions of dollars each year putting sleeves on pile and putting in some new pile on the trestles to keep the dock safe until we tear it out. So this is the phasing plan. And on the left-hand side, well, in the middle of where the blue is where our, really where our docks are. You can see the dock in there on the, across the blue and a little bit into the purple and a little bit to the left. We've been primarily working on the north end, which is on the left side. We have created two new barge docks. One that goes dry when the tide goes out, so the barge sits on the bottom. The next is the wet barge dock, which the barge will stay wet when the tide goes out. And then the next is the orange, which is the north extension, and then the north extension next to it, and green, and then what we'll call a tan or lighter color there. So this is all going to be finished by, the dock will all be finished by 2014. The backlands above it may not have all of the utilities in it, may not be paved and have lighted until 2015, but that's kind of the schedule at the present time. We build it in phases so that we can stay in service. In other words, we have ships coming in every day, almost every day, and so we just can't go in there and just do whatever we want and add on to it to the port because we have ships coming in. We have to jockey them back and forth. So we went out to the north and added 60 acres of new ground. We went out to the south, which is on the right side where the purple and the red is, and we're adding about 40 acres in that area. Some of it's filled now. The blue, the south backlands, it says that's been filled. And so it's remodeling an old house and then feeding the family every night. And becomes a problem sometimes. So, and we've made some mistakes in judgment about how fast we can build it because it takes longer than we anticipated. By the time we moved the dirt in and we put the bulkhead in and the tail walls, do the compaction, put the dock cap on, and put the utilities in, it's a longer project than what we thought. On the red, on the south end, the purple and the red there, that's a 5 to 6 year project. Doesn't look like it, does it? But it's a lot of dirt. It's about 35% of our 11 million cubic yards of dirt that we'll use during this project. And a lot of steel, a whole wall of course is steel. But that's an important area. It houses two petroleum docks for two ships to come in at the same time and unload or take out fuel. Mind you, we haul all the fuel to Western Alaska. Some fuel goes directly from Seattle, the heating fuel, but almost all of it comes to the port, and then it's hauled out of there just to
which goes through the Unimac Pass into western Alaska. And so, and all of the fuel that we supply to the Elmendorf Air Force Base and to the Senator Stevens Airport. So, in addition to that, we put our cement ship in that area. And they stay 2 to 3 weeks at a time. In addition to that, our cruise ship will be down on that end, plus some other special cargo. And when we move those ships down to that area, they'll stay there. When we move the ships to the north side that are in the blue now, we move them over there. That's our container ships and some pipe ships. We'll move them back eventually, the container ships. They'll move back into the blue area when we finish the blue. The big red, I call it, but it's red and purple on your map. That's a $300 million project. And I want to start that in late 2012, early 2013. And I can't start that project until I have a pretty good idea I'm going to be able to finish it on time and a pretty good idea that I have the funds committed. And because once we start, we have to finish it because it's a crucial area for our petroleum business, which is our container business. Brings in the largest part of our revenue, but the fuel business is very important to the state of Alaska, and we need to take care of that too. We incidentally grossed more tonnage last year than we did the year before, and we're at the 4 million ton mark now. Our low was 3.5 million. Our high was 5 million tons. But that was when Flint Hills was hauling more fuel down and we were sending almost two tankers a month of other kinds of product to foreign countries. And they stopped doing that, so we lost a lot of tonnage. But on the other hand, I think we're going to pick up a lot of that now in the next year. So I'll move to the next slide and the port expansion team slide. We have federal dollars, and so we we have federal dollars, so we have a federal agency. The Maritime Administration is our lead agency. That's what you have to have. And they have a project manager called ICRC. It's a company. And it does our design, construction, and hires subcontractors to do the work. And up in the right-hand corner, we're just the owner. We furnish all the money and coordinate the construction phasing to fit the port's needs. That's how it works. And the port covers all of its operational costs, and we put all of our profits back into the expansion project. The project has received $279 million to date. And $265 million has been obligated. Of that $279 million, all but about $110 to $120 million has been spent on the old port, new roads, new drainage from Elmendorf Air Force Base through the port, buried all the power, build a building float for the Coast Guard to use for the protection of the port on the water side. We built a checkpoint 3 for our security after 9/11. And so we've done a lot of work inside the port, put a rail line behind the port, put a road behind the port. And so we've been very busy doing those things. So eventually,
we'll come back to you and back to the legislature with a sheet showing how we got from the original thoughts of money, which is about $450 million, to the billion-dollar mark that we've estimated at the present time. The current project is $1 billion, as the slide says. If you're on that slide now, current project cost is $1 billion, that's what it says. This is much higher than the initial estimate. However, there's been many changes to the original design, and the largest contributing factor is listed below. Anyway, it's design changes that went along with learning about the sediments and the currents when we were doing the phases of construction. And so we've had to change some types of construction, an angle of when we stopped for the season. And we have two new essential facilities that remain operational following a maximum contingency earthquake or other kind of structures. We have two areas of the docks, almost 3,000 feet, that will stand something far more severe than a 64 earthquake. All the dock is designed to stand more than a 64 earthquake. And we've increased more linear dock space in order to accommodate customer needs. When we started to get estimates for steel, 2005, steel was $110 a ton. We paid $221 in 2008. The galvanization is 30% on top of the steel price. That makes the steel last longer. And so we thought that was a good investment. And we don't know what the steel prices are going to be now, but we've probably leveled out a little bit, and because we'll be ordering steel again this year. And so we'll have a better handle on that. We've done a lot of things that we hadn't planned on doing that we found that we needed to do. So all that has increased increased dredging costs. Blue whales, I'm not complaining about National Marine Fisheries and NOAA. We work very, very closely with them. I think they've been pretty good to us. They'll come out with a new rule here, which was supposed to be in October of last year, but they'll probably come out with a rule in March, whether we'll be in critical habitat or not. In a way, it doesn't matter, because they've about done everything to us that they could do. But critical habitat's a dirty word, and we don't want it associated with us. So I think that we might be taken out of the critical habitat. And we're trying to get some of the conditions on our permit. We're trying to get some relief. We shut down 2 hours before low tide, so 2 hours after low tide. There's two of those a day. And we shut down when a whale gets in our zone, which is a mile and a quarter from anywhere we're working. We usually have three sets of crews working at the same time, and you know, a lot of cranes working, and if it gets foggy or weather conditions prevent us from being able to see too well, we have to shut down. Certain times of the day, we can't use our vibration hammers or impact hammers. The picture you'll see on that slide that says beluga whales at the top, you'll see a scissor lift, and we have four of those along our construction from one end to the other of the port, from the north end to the south end. And those are whale observers up there. They're just not kids. They're people that have some knowledge of the mammal situation, and
and they're really ex-NOAA employees.
Governor, we have to gavel out in 10 minutes, okay. So I don't know how much time you need, but we, in case there's
questions. I'm coming down pretty fast here. So around the corner at Karen's Point, we have another one, and so we pay about $5 million a year for what I just said, and then we figure there's another $5 or $10 million a year of efficiencies that we don't have under construction. So if we give them $20 million, 15 of it's going to go out the way. But there's nothing we can do about it. We are trying to get some relief. The next slide is the expansion project is moving forward. We had not a good year in 2009. We had bum work. We didn't know how serious it was until 2009 and really until 2010 when we had a new contract going forward to finish the bulkhead on the north end. And we found that we had a lot of damage. And so we've had to inspect all of that, and we have, and we have found damage. And 2011, this year, we'll probably be letting a contract starting almost next week to go forward. We uncovered all of the problems, except we have two areas to inspect yet. There'll be there's a performance bond, litigation. There'll be negotiations. It's going to go on. We have some money coming back, and you know how that goes. And you're not going to get it all. You'll get as much as you can. We've done a lot of work in the last 6 months on correcting the problems of the past. So we've had a lot of meetings with Mayor Ann and ICRC. The contract structure must provide clear accountability and absolute protection from faulty construction and poor oversight. And the port's going to require additional financial protection to assure the work is completed on time and a proper workmanship. And we have implemented an oversight committee that will meet once a week to go over all of the figures and examinations of the work going on, that's proper. And we'll have somebody from the city, and we'll have a couple of people from the port, ICE, and from MARAD, the federal lead agency, and probably the Corps of Engineers from time to time on this oversight committee to make sure that we get the work done properly. And I think I might have missed a slide, but I probably missed a point or two. But so if you have any questions on this last slide where it says thank you at the top, you're looking at the south end of the north extension, and you can see all the cranes. I think there's maybe six or seven cranes in the background there. And you'll always have that many cranes, and you may have three or four more sitting in another location doing the same kind of work. Out in the ocean there is a hopper dredge that does maintenance dredging for us by the Corps. In the background is another dredge, but it's a bucket dredge doing transitional dredging. That means doing dredging where we've never dredged before because our port is longer now. So it's a big project. It's a piece of infrastructure that needs to be done, service all of us, except for Southeast Alaska. And if you built a gas line, you probably couldn't build it without having this port in operation with the land that we have available to set pipe down to do things. So it's important, and we know we're going to have a good year this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we have, first of all, Representative Peterson. There are several questions, so we'll try to go through them as quick as we can.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Governor Sheffield, I was wondering if you found a solution to the new silting issues. I've heard that because of some of the pilings that were put in, it changed the flow of the water, and some, you're having silting problems that you hadn't had in the past.
Yes. I turned back to the phasing map here, and that light part up there, right over Madam Chair's head. Right,
don't move.
Very good. Yeah, don't move. We're going to use that arm in there. That's been added. What we did was we had a sharp corner here, and that's where Totem Ocean Trailer sits now. And so when we come out 400 feet for the dock face, and then you go in and you leave it here like this, we had a sharp angle in here. And that causes the silt to come into this corner. And that, what we've done to alleviate that problem is that we've dredged before the dredgers left for the season, dredged down 10 more feet than they normally would. We don't really have a problem until April, because that's when the rivers above us up in the Mat-Su Valley run off, the warm weather comes, and here comes the silt. And it will just gravitate right into that corner. So we didn't do what they were going to do last year. The Corps was going to come early, and so they'd be there to dredge, but they didn't. They had to go out in Dutch Harbor and never got in on time. So this year they're going to be there at the end of March. So we'll be ready for it if it happens. If for some reason it fills in before that, we have a plan B, plan C, you might say, that we're working on. It's our tugboat up there. They have the tractor tug wheel goes around now. You could feed water down there by pump, and then the tractor tug spinning it and moves that dirt out. And we think we can move that out and into the tide and let it go. And we're going to test that about next month. We're going to test that to see if we can do it. In the meantime, when we extend the north part into that light color, that we'll have a less of an angle. We're going to reduce that angle. It doesn't really show it on the map up there. But that, the Corps says, and the tugboat guys who really know what goes on down there, say that'll solve the problem. Because we still have horizon lines on the right side of that is going to be there for a couple of years, so we move them over there so we can attack the blue. So it's kind of a learning process. Sorry for the long answer.
Representative Fife, thank you. I think that was something that all of us were interested in. Representative Fife.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Governor, on the with all the several of the other freshman legislators, I took the port tour back in December, and one of the issues that came up there was a shoaling issue developing on the Point McKenzie side of the Nick Arm. I guess basically it reduces the space you have for vessels to turn around. How much of an impact is that shoaling issue, and how soon is that going to become more factor in your operation?
Well, the impact now is the fact that the ships coming in to the port of Anchorage, if I'm sitting here, I'm the port, the Mat-Su dock is over there. Port McKenzie is right over here. Again. So the ships come in, and they used to come in and they went like this, our ships, went up here like this, and turned around, came back in here and docked to the port. Now they have to come way down close to us and come along, and then they go up and make that turn. They need a mile and a quarter to turn, and then turn around and come back in. That's not a problem in the spring and the summer when there's no ice, or the summertime. In the wintertime, with the ice and the winds, they say we could be putting our ships at risk. And, you know, you can't be against that because they got a 600-800 foot ship and they don't turn too fast anyway. And so, you know, maybe we don't have enough horsepower in our tugs. Maybe they're concerned about that. So the shoal has been there some time and needs to be looked at. So the Corps said it's a $2 million study. They're going to study what caused the shoal, what are they going to do about it, and how much is it going to cost to take care of the problem. So they want $2 million to study it, figure out that cost. But they want a 50% cost share, so that's $1 million. So I figure that the Fort McKenzie ought to pay half of that, we'll pay half, or the state will pay the whole million or something. But we have to give them $1 million to get the study talking to start it. It'll take 3 years to do that. So we're okay for a while. I mean, the shoal's coming in every year now. No, every year, 3 years, but now every year they study it and they map it. So we know exactly what it's doing. I'm anxious to see the, not anxious, but I'll see the next map in about July of this year. It is a problem.
Follow-up?
So the possibility exists the shoal is just wandering around and could start wandering back the other way?
Well, it's wandering down. It wandered down toward us, and it seems to be going, it seems to be maybe slowing down a bit, the Corps thinks, and it may be going to the south a little bit, not coming out this way, but going south. Yeah, I keep thinking that we're more concerned about it than they are, but anyway, it is a problem. And I think we'll know more about it this summer. But we're going to have the Corps. I've committed $500,000 to my part to get them to start thinking about putting together the scope of work to find out the problem.
Thank you, Governor.
Because the McKenzie ships, they have to do the same thing.
Sure.
Come down and blink an eye at us and right back up.
We've got one more minute.
Thank you. I'll just be quick. Thank you very much, Governor. What is the municipality of Anchorage's commitment to the project in terms of bonding capacity or share of the project costs that have been expended so far?
Well, we've I don't know what that slide was. Emily, is it back there? Okay. So far, we have the federal funds involved is $138 million, state funds are $91 million, and the Port of Anchorage funds are $49 million. And then we have a $75 million line of credit, so which is supported by the municipality. And so they're in it. We can only bond for about $75 million. We don't have the revenue to go over that. Eventually, we'll probably end up with a revenue bond in the city to the tune of about $125 million. Plus, the money we put our profits in, which is our cash flow, is $4 to $6 million a year.
And one more question left. Senator Menard.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Governor Sheffield should probably know where I'm going to ask this question. But do you think Port McKenzie, being an export port, will complement the Port of Anchorage and make it a South Central major hub for shipping?
Well, you know, people say it another way to me. What's your competition doing? And we're really the Fort McKenzie is not any competition to us. They're going to be an export port of coal or whatever comes down from the interior, and we're an import port. We bring in commodities and we go out empty, basically. We might have some backhauls from Asian ships one day. When we get the port finished, we'll have Asian ships coming and dropping containers, and then we'll move those to Seattle, and they'll get to Chicago before they would to L.A. and Long Beach. So, but we're a different kind of port, and so we're only competition. They're only competition to us for money.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Governor. You've really given us a lot of information. We really appreciate it. And next Tuesday, we will again meet with the Senate in this room, and we will hear from the Mobility Coalition, the Kinnick Arm Bridge Toll Authority, and Point McKenzie Rail Extension. So we'll learn a lot more next week. So thank you very much, and we will adjourn.